So, what is the best way to get free? To get yourself free? Pardon?
Liberation.
Liberation?
Be unattached.
Be unattached?
No self.
Pardon?
No self.
That's right. If you want to get yourself free, you got to get rid of yourself. It's the only way it works. So, tonight, that's what we're going to talk about. Pure awareness and selflessness. We're going to talk about it tomorrow night, too. Tonight, I want to look at it from a traditional perspective, and then tomorrow, I'll just leap off a cliff, and we'll see what happens. So, pure awareness is this, referred to it a lot. It's this clear, kind, spacious awareness which has no self in it at all. It's just a flow of phenomena. And dependent origination, part of what dependent origination shows is how this free, pure, open awareness accumulates tension. Right? And as it accumulates tension, the awareness gets distorted. And one of the most intractable distortions is this sense of an enduring permanent self. And the result of an enduring permanent self is pain and suffering. Not just that, but without that self, if there's no one to suffer, there is no suffering. So if you want to get free, you need to relax the tension, which clears the distortion, which dissolves the sense of self, which reveals this kind, luminous awareness that has always been there back behind it all. Simple, huh? It actually is quite simple, but it's not very easy. And the Buddha would agree. But he insisted that this dissolving, delusion, this illusion of a solid self is actually quite attainable. It can be done, and it's the key to finding a deeper peace and well-being. So I thought it might be worth spending a couple evenings on it. So tonight, first, what I want to do is go back and we'll do a quick pass through dependent origination, and I just want to add a couple of elements, kind of an undercurrent to them. And then I will read you a story from the suttas, my favorite little stories about Bahia, the bark cloth, and it illustrates one of the major ways that the Buddha actually worked with self and selflessness. And then we'll look at some practices and things that you can do to work with this. So, first thing to remember about all this is that is this relationship between tension and distortion. So when there is tension, it creates distortion. If I am tense because I'm worried about terrorists infiltrating our sangha, right? Then when I sit and I look around at all you, probably most of what I notice is anyone who's got shifty eyes or seems to have suspicious motives. Or, so it distorts my perception, right? If I am uptight because I think my nose is too big, when I look around at all of you, what do you think I'll see?
Little noses.
Yeah, we'll see whose nose is bigger than mine and whose is littler. Right? And if I am really gung-ho for freedom and liberation, then when I look around, I don't see noses anymore. But I see who looks peaceful and who looks confused. You know, who's smiling and who has a deadpan and what does that mean? So, again, any kind of tension just it colors our perception quite deeply. And dependent origination, I want to run through that, as I said, because it shows how all this happens. So dependent origination is it's usually described as this motley bunch of 12 characters who stand up there, and what they do is each one punches a shoulder to the guy on his right. So contact punches Vedna. Vedna punches clinging, tanha, and tanha punches craving, and craving punches clinging, and clinging punches
bhava,
yes, habitual tendencies, and right on down the line. So these 12 stooges, they're just the surface manifestation of what's going on. Underneath it, there are there's this continuum of at least four different strands that are steadily increasing. There's this increase in tension, increase of distortion, increase of a sense of self, and an increase in suffering that follow along through that whole flow. For example, we'll just start with contact. So, as you remember, contact, it's the sixth element in this thing, right in the middle, is what happens when there's a sensory energy, light, sound, hits an organ with awareness, there's a raw sensation. And in that raw sensation, there's no self. It's just a raw sensation. There's nothing else there. And a little bit of tension comes into that raw sensation, and it creates a vedna, feeling tone. It can be pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And then that feeling tone, if it's pleasant, the feeling tone, a little bit more tension comes into it. If it's pleasant, it goes into an urge to move towards or to grasp something. And if it's unpleasant, there's the urge to push it away. So it creates this sense of there's something in here who's pushing and pulling on something out there. So it's just the beginning of a kind of sense of self. And up to this point, it's all been pre-verbal and pre-conceptual. If more tension comes into it, then we come to clinging, upadana, where the mind kind of shrink wraps around this sensation, these urges, and puts a label on it. So let's say the first raw sensations out there is I'm groping through a room and I feel something that is cold, you know, wet and smooth, and have no idea what it is. That's just a raw contact. If it's pleasant, I want to grab it. Unpleasant, push it away. And then this label comes on it, you know, glass of cold water. Okay. And with that concept, it concretizes everything a little bit. There's something out there, and it also concretizes the sense of someone in here. And you put a little more tension into it, and it becomes much more solid. There's a sense of wanting to do something about it. Okay. So, and with all of that, the sense of self gets concretized. So, and then as we do something, which can be a physical action, a mental action, or a verbal action, that can lead to suffering. And when we are suffering, when we are angry, upset, worried, the sense of self is really very, very, very dense. Right?
When is the sense of self arise in contact or feeling tone or perception?
It comes along with all of them.
Even in
time. Yeah, it gets stronger and stronger. We think of the sense of self as black and white, but you actually see it. It's something that rises and falls. There's all kinds of gradations. No, with the first contact, that's just raw sensation.
Feeling, how about feeling tone?
feeling tone, there's a little bit, you begin to get this little bit of, it's not so much of a sense of self there, but it's sort of, you know, unpleasant, you know, maybe. It's when the feeling tone goes into the urge to either get away or to move towards, there begins to become the sense is that there's something here that wants to push or pull on something out there. And so there's a little bit of a sense of self that comes in there. Yeah, and then the labels come on it, and that really solidifies it. And then we do some action, and okay, so there we are. So you'll see those four currents that go on underneath it. There is the this downward flow. There's a steady increase in tension. And with a steady increase in tension, there's an increase in distortion. And along with that increase in distortion, there's this growing sense of self. And with a growing sense of self, there is a potential. It's not a guarantee, but there's a potential for suffering. Okay. So the Buddha sought to find some way that we could alleviate the tension, to clear the distortion, to dissolve the sense of self so that we find a deeper, more abiding sense of well-being. Okay. So, the first time that I experienced, that I recognized as pure awareness, was with the Korean Zen master at Sansein. He was the guy who had the little wooden statue I was talking about. Did I tell you that about my interview with him? Or did I just... Okay. My very first interview with him, I walked into the interview room. And it wasn't like the library there. The room was about almost the size of this. And he was sitting on a little platform over there one side with his... one of his chief students with him. And as I walked in the door, he looked up at me and he said, "There it is," meaning a moment of fully enlightened awareness. And I looked inside and he was right. My awareness was clear, luminous, spacious, tremendous sense of freedom. And he said, "Now you've lost it." And he was right, because it just piled up with all these ideas and stuff on top of it. And I got it at that moment that all of us have these moments all the time of that pure, clear awareness. But it has no tension in it to draw our attention. And it is so far away from how we see ourselves that mostly it just comes up and passes without us ever noticing it. And his gift to me, and it was an amazing gift, was actually to catch me in one of those moments and point it out definitively enough that I could see it. So even though it faded in the next moment, I had the memory of it and what that was like. And I knew it was real and tangible. And I'm confident that all of us have those moments all the time. They just fade so quickly that they don't register. The difference between us and a Buddha is for us there are these little flickers that go by, and for a Buddha, or for an Arahat, they become an abiding state. So the Buddha's path doesn't create this awareness. It just relaxes the distortion, relaxes the tension, that clears the distortion, that reveals what's been there all along. And as I was saying the other night, I don't think this clear awareness belongs to us. It's not ours. It's not our awareness. It is just a fundamental property of the universe. It's fundamental because it can't be broken down into anything else. And I think our nervous system, if it does anything, amplifies awareness, but it doesn't create it. So some people will call this non-dual awareness, because in that awareness, subject and object merge back into just this flow of phenomena. Okay. You with me on this? Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
When you use the word luminous a lot, do you mean literally luminous, like not a feeling of light, but like light, like photons, like?
There are no photons. Right. It's tricky to describe this because in that pure awareness, there is, I used to call it just knowingness. There's a knowing, and it's direct. It doesn't come through the senses. There's just knowing. And then what happens is the mind translates it into metaphors. And they will. It'll translate, in oftentimes, and usually into sensory metaphors, so that it has. How else could you describe it? Sort of luminous, spacious, soft, kind, all pervading.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's not an actual physical light. But you know, if you're one who visualizes easily as it arises, there may be this, you know, vision inside of luminous, but it's not actually a light.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so let's look at some text. This is the Bahia Sutta, that Bahia, the bark cloth, which is number 1.10 in the Udana, and the Udana is one of the very oldest texts around. This version was compiled by John Ireland and Thanissaro Bhikkhu. In other words, I saw their translations and I created my own out of it using a lot of notes from Lee Brazington, for those of you who know him, and John Peacock. They're deep scholars of this. So, thus have I heard. At one time, the Blessed One was staying in Shavasti, in Jetta's Grove, at Anathapindika's Park. Can you say that three times fast? Anathapindika's Park. It goes very fast in my mind. I just can't get out on the tongue. Shavasti is a small city in northern India. Jetta's Grove is an area, is a grove that's just outside Shravasti, and Anathapindika's Park is a tract of land in that park that was given to the monks by Anathapindika. He was a wealthy merchant, a very wealthy merchant, and a lay follower of the Buddha. And there, they created a little monastery there. And the Buddha probably spent maybe about 30 out of the 40 rains retreats. His ministry lasted about 40 years between his enlightenment and his death, and he probably spent about 30 of the rains retreats, they call them, which is the during the monsoons when the rains are coming down, all the monks go in for a long retreat. He probably spent 30 of those there. At that time, Bahia the bark cloth was living by the seashore at Saparaka. Saparaka is on the west coast of India, probably near modern-day Mumbai. It's about 1,200 miles from Shravasti. The later commentaries suggest that Bahia was probably a sailor who had shipwrecked and lost everything, including his clothes, so he had made his clothes for him out of bark. But John Peacock, who's a contemporary scholar, has a much more plausible explanation for it, that Bahia was probably a follower of the Brihadaranyaka. That's another one to say. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It's one of the Vedic scriptures. Brihadaranyaka translates as the great forest. So people who were followers of this Upanishad were into trees. You know, they communed with trees, they ate from trees, they made clothes out of trees, etc.
Tree huggers.
Tree huggers. Yeah, they were tree lovers. Talking with them. This little piece of trivia will actually become very important later on in the sutta. Bahia was respected, revered, honored, venerated, and given homage, and was one who obtained the requisites of robes, alms food, lodging, and medicines. So this indicates that Bahia was not just an isolated yogi. He actually had a fairly large following. Now, while Bahia was in seclusion, this reflection arose in the mind of Bahia. Am I one of those in the world who is an arahat or on the path to arahatship? So Bahia is wondering about his practice. An arahat is a fully enlightened being, so he's reflecting to himself, am I an arahat? Am I a fully awakened being? He's wondering about his practice. Have any of you ever wondered about your progress?
Is that one of those things where if you have to ask, you're not?
Absolutely. If you are, you know. If you're not enlightened, you may think you are, so there can be delusion, but I don't think you can be fully enlightened and not know it. So he's asking this question, am I one of those in the world who is an arahat or on the path to arahatship? Then a deva, who was a former blood relation of Bahia of the bark cloth, understood the reflection in his mind. Being compassionate and wishing to benefit him, he approached Bahia and said, you, Bahia, are neither an arahat or on a path to arahatship. You do not follow a practice whereby you could become an arahat. So don't take these dialogues too literally. At the Buddha's times, no one really understood how thoughts arise out of unconscious feelings and out of the unconscious mind, repressed feelings, as well as just intuitive inspirations. So when these arose, oftentimes they're described as dialogues with spirits. And in fact, particularly, I mean, for us, you know, when those big inspirations come in, they do actually feel like they come from somewhere else. So, but in the modern sensibilities, he's having this kind of internal dialogue. In this case, Bahia reflects on his progress and he thinks, nah, I'm not enlightened, I'm not liberated. In fact, I'm not even sure this practice is getting me there. So he is experiencing doubt, big time doubt. Have you ever had doubt about your practice and wondered where it's going? This is Bahia talking to the deva. Then, in the world, who are the arahats and who knows the path? So he's asking himself, where in the world is a good teacher? And he has a very strong intuitive flash that's very specific. Bahia, in a far country, is a town called Srivasti. There lives a blessed one who is fully enlightened. He is indeed an arahat, and he teaches a dhamma, leading to arahatship. Bahia was profoundly stirred. Then and there he departed from Saparaka, stopping only for one night everywhere along the way, and went to Srivasti and Anathan Pandika's park. I don't know about you, but when I get an inspiration to go on a retreat, I check my bank account, I look for plane flights, I look at my calendar, check with my family, find someone who can feed the cats, stop the newspaper delivery, put on an automatic responder on my email. It can take me months, you know, to plan a few weeks away. But Bahia is much more dedicated. He gets this inspiration, and he is out of there. He just leaves. Pardon? Yeah, so he wouldn't have to worry about that anyway. Thank you for that correction. I'll note it in my notes. And so he takes off, and he doesn't stop at health spas. He doesn't stop at any friends along the way. He just stops every night to rest a little bit and then takes off in the morning. So how about you? What kind of machinations did you go through to get here? So, Bahi arrives at Jetta's Grove. At that time, a number of monks were walking up and down in the open air. Bahi of the bark cloth approached those monks and said, "Where, revered sirs, is the Blessed One living? We wish to see that Arahat, the fully enlightened one." And they respond, "The Blessed One, Bahia, is gone for alms food among the houses." Bahia hurried out of Jetta's Grove. Entering Shivasti, he saw the Blessed One walking for alms food. Pleasing, lovely to see, with calm senses and tranquil mind, attained to perfect poise, and calm, controlled, a perfected one, watchful with restrained senses. Do you think the writer likes the Buddha? The lovely picture. On seeing, Bahi approached, fell down with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and said, "Teach me Dhamma, Blessed One. Teach me Dhamma, a one well gone, so that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." Again, we have a measure of Bahia's dedication. He arrives at Anathapandika's park and sees the monks are out doing their walking meditation. And actually, I mean, my inclination would have been actually to sit respectfully and wait for them to complete their practice. But Bahia just walks right up to him and says, "Where's this Buddha guy? You know, I really want to see him right now." And they say, "He's off on his alms round." Well, this is the Buddha we're talking about, so you would think he would, sit down there and wait for the Buddha to return. But not Bahia. He takes off, he runs into town, he sees the Buddha, and right there in the middle of the neighborhoods, in the middle of his alms round, he runs up the guy, bows down to his feet, and drops down to his feet and says, "Teach me, teach me." Upon being spoken to thus, the Blessed One said, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia. We have entered among the houses for alms food." So for a Buddha to say it is an unsuitable time is about as brash as saying, "Come on, fella, we're out here doing alms round. This is not the time. People have worked hard for a long time to prepare this food. Cool your jets, sit down, wait, I'll talk to you later." What do you think Bahia does? A second time, Bahia said to the Blessed One, "It is difficult to know for certain, revered sir, how long the Blessed One will live, or how long I will live. Teach me the Dhamma, so it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." So despite the reprimand, Bahia makes another request, and he ups the ante a little bit. He says, "Life is short, who knows what's going to happen. I could die, you could die. By the time you finish your alms round, both of us might be dead, so please, teach me now." And the Buddha shoos him away. Oh, I didn't read that part. A second time, the Blessed One said, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia. We have entered upon the houses for alms food," so he shoos him away. A third time, Bahia said to the Buddha, "It is difficult to know for certain how long any of us will live. Teach me Dhamma for my good and happiness for a long time." Well, there's this formula. If you ask the Buddha three times, what they say is he has to respond. I'm not sure the Buddha has to, but it indicates, the number three indicates a kind of depth and a completion. So there's this sense, from the Buddha that this guy is really dedicated and really means it. And so he responds. "Bahia," this is the Buddha talking, "Bahia, you should train thus. In seeing, there is merely seeing. In hearing, there is merely hearing. In sensing, there is merely sensing. In cognizing, there is merely cognizing. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia." So why is he giving Bahia these particular instructions?
That's what he
Mm-hmm. How come?
Because the Buddha just knows.
How, I wouldn't get that. But
how does he know? Okay, yeah, so good. By he knows. So remember, the Buddha trained, as a young man in all the Vedic scriptures. I mean, that was part of his education before he went out on the quest. So Bahia's dress in the bark cloth marked him as a follower of the Briha Dharanyaka Upanishad. So let me read you just a passage from the Briha Dharanyaka Upanishad. It encourages yogis to look for the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the uncognized cognizer. This is thyself, the true controller, the immortal. This is from the Upanishad. Imperishable is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than this, there is naught that sees. Other than it, there is naught that hears. Other than it, there is naught that thinks. Other than it, there is naught that understands. So the Buddha sees. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So the Buddha sees that he's probably a follower of the Upanishad because he knows all these. So for years, Bahia has been searching for the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the Atman, the true self behind all of it. And he's looked under every rock and behind every tree. You know, he's examined his feelings, his thoughts, his perceptions. And he has been unable to find the unthought thinker, the uncognized cognizer. So from his reflections earlier in the sutta, we know he's started to doubt this practice. So he's been doing it for years, and he hasn't been able to succeed in this. So the Buddha sees this and says to him, in the seeing, there's just the seeing. And to drive the point home, he continues, Bahia, when there's only seeing in seeing, only hearing in hearing, only sensing in sensing, only cognizing in cognizing, then you will not be with that. When you are not with that, you will not be in that. When you are not in that, you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. Remember, the Buddha didn't speak English. So you have to listen sort of deeply into these words. When he says, then you will not be with that, he's saying, when there is just hearing in the hearing, there is no you with the hearing. When there's just seeing in the seeing, there is no you with the hearing. There is no you in the hearing. There is no you here and beyond. There is no you. There is just pure awareness. There is no self, just awareness. You get that? Okay. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dhamma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth, right then and there, was freed from the taints through lack of grasping. So lack of grasping means he relaxed, and freed from the taints means?
He was liberated.
He was liberated. Yeah, he became full. Kaboom. Became an arahat. Zap.
Oh, he had this area. No.
Pardon?
We hear the same thing, but we still...
Well, if the Buddha was around and he talked to you directly, you get it.
Let me finish the sutta. We're actually going to come back to that. It's a very important point. What's the difference here? But let me finish this out. Having instructed Bahia the bark cloth with these words of the Dhamma, the Blessed One left. Now the story takes a dark turn.
I'm just expressing concern for
I know. Would you like to leave the room for this part? I mean, this is.
it's very stressful for the unenviable.
Not long after the Buddha departed, a cow with calf attacked Bahia of the bark cloth and killed him. So Bahia's premonitions were right. His days were numbered. But now he is freed, you know, and found the deepest possible kinds of well-being. So the moral of the story is...
Get on with it.
And it's also that if you get on with it with lack of grasping, then the freedom can arise. So, shall we go back and go through those words again? because the Buddha's instructions here bear looking at a little more closely. When there's only seeing and seeing, hearing and hearing, sensing and sensing, cognizing and cognizing, then you will not be with that. When you are not with that, you will not be in that. When you are not in that, you will be neither here, nor beyond, nor in between the two. And here in these words, he becomes fully liberated. You've heard him twice. Oh, you're liberated. Good. I was just wondering. I was hoping we would pick up one or two.
Just hearing that last phrase reminds me.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So.
We have to hear it three times.
You have to. Okay.
One more time.
One more time. Okay. Here we are. You ready? When there is only seeing in the seeing, hearing in the hearing. No. Okay. You want to hear it a third time? When there is only seeing in the seeing, hearing in the hearing, sensing in sensing, cognizing in cognizing, then there will not. Then you will not be with that. When you are not with that, you will not be in that. When you are not in that, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two.
What is
you are not in that, whatever that that sensory experience. You are not in the, there is no you in the hearing, there is no you in the thinking, there is no you. So obviously the Buddha was a little more charismatic than me, so maybe that's the problem.
If there's no you, how come you can be an arahant?
Well, if... shall I read it a third time if we have an arahat? Maybe they could explain. Fourth time. It won't work. Okay. So another difference may be that Bahia was listening to this a little bit differently than we are. Okay? So when the Buddha said, there is no you in the hearing, there is no you here, there, or anywhere, it was not actually a statement of logic. It was not an argument. It was not a philosophical position. It was actually a set of instructions on how to direct your awareness. Right? So the Buddha is instructing the Bahia to look into the hearing, into the seeing, into the sensing, and to see if he can find a self there. So it's not a logical argument. It's like a meditation instruction. And the distinction is really important. As I was saying the other night, logically it's impossible to prove anything doesn't exist. Right? So I search through the building, I can't find any of those little space aliens. But if I search and search and search over and over and over, after a while it may begin to sink in a little bit that maybe they actually aren't here. Maybe there are none. Little spacemen. See, I believe there's little spacemen infesting this place, and lack of evidence doesn't prove their lack of spacemen, it just proves lack of evidence. But if I search over and over and over and over again, it may begin to settle in that maybe my belief in spacemen is just a little, is a trick of my mind. Okay? So here we have Bahia the bark cloth, who has been searching over and over and over for many years looking for this self. In the seeing, in the hearing, in the sensing, inside himself, here, there, everywhere. He's been searching and searching and searching, and he can't find this unseen seer, the Atman, the true self behind it all. And he thinks he's failed, that the practice has failed. And the Buddha, knowing that he is a follower of this Upanishad, these tree huggers who did this practice of searching for the true self, the Buddha knows he has been doing this for a long time. So this is what Bill is referring to, the Buddha's just incredibly skillful means of recognizing this guy's been doing this, and so he uses it. And he says to him, basically, you know, Bahia, you know this hasn't worked. The reason is not because you haven't been doing the practice right. The reason is because there is no self. There is no Atman. There is no separate, undying self-essence behind it all. And Bahia knows the territory of searching this for so well that he gets it. It just clicks. And with that, he's liberated. He gets it that there is no self.
And this is a minor point, but he knew his name, too. And he never met him.
Yes. Yes.
Minor, but hey.
Yes.
Probably knew how much he weighed, too.
Knew his shoe size.
Saddle.
Saddle size.
The term of Arahant is not just used by Buddha. Is everybody know that?
An Arahant is a fully liberated being. A Buddha is an Arahant who got there completely by himself. No, he's not a Buddha.
But
he becomes
the term of Arahant means, is that a popular term at that time, even if you are not Buddhist? But everybody knows that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't just belong to the Buddhism.
No. It was around. The Buddha used drew quite heavily from the culture and the beliefs and ideas, and then added just a few things and twisted them a little bit. It was a way of trying to talk to them in a language they understood. And so we used a lot of these.
So you don't have to be the Buddhist to become Arahant?
No, you don't. You might have to be a Buddhist to be called an Arahant, but you don't have to be a Buddhist to become liberated, which is what it means. Yeah, it's not parochial. Nobody owns that.
I have a question. This still vexes me, but it's becoming more clear. So there's no self like this. Like, this is just an amalgamation of experiences and time I was born and cultural things, and I get all that. So when you hit the point of liberation, though, there's still an irreducible perceptor or consciousness that exists, but it's not identifying with anything?
Yes.
That is the most thing you can reduce this all down to is just consciousness, perception of whatever.
So I've mentioned it a little bit before. We haven't talked about it a lot, but it's the difference between the relative world and the absolute world. And so pure awareness is unconditioned, so it's not part of the conditioned or the relative world, and they are different ways of sensing and feeling and understanding. And so he's talking out of the absolute. And because I know some of you had experiences when it goes very deep, you see something and it's like, oh, you know, there is, it doesn't matter. This thing I've been worried about doesn't matter. And then you come back into the world of the relative and it does matter, you know. And so just because the Buddha or an arahat sees that there is no absolute self doesn't mean he walks around and puts his foot into a paper shredder. You know, he understands a relative and honors them both. It's just
does
not...
Does he stay out of the way of cows with calves?
Apparently not.
Yeah, but you're still subject, even if you're enlightened, you're still subject to karma. I mean, isn't there a lot of stories in the suttas? Here's somebody much better, they achieve enlightenment, and then, well, even the Buddha, he died of food poisoning.
Buddha had back pain.
Yeah.
Lots of places where he says, you know, Ananda, you give the talk tonight, I need to go lie down. So the comma continues to play out. It's just that there is no fighting against it anymore. There's no struggle against it. So there's the comma may take a while to run out, but you're not creating more. Okay. Okay. So I think all this suggests some pretty simple practices that we can do. One is that there is, what's being suggested here is there's some value to actually spend some time looking inside, investigating, seeing if you can find where this sense of self is inside you. And I think if we look for it, what we begin to see is that the sense of self is probably closely akin to like a psychological state. You know, the sense of self has feelings, ideas, sensations, a bunch of stuff, you know, desires. It's like a psychological state. And any psychological state waxes and wanes. Right? So when we're angry or depressed or moody or grumpy or frightened or embarrassed, the sense of self becomes very, very strong, almost opaque. You know? And when we're in love, when we're mellow, when you know, we're out resting in the trees, you know, when there's that softness, the sense of self gets very faint. Right? And almost dissolves. Sometimes it completely dissolves. But the deal is that when the sense of self is strong, when we're depressed or embarrassed or something, we really notice it. But when you're out there at the end of the day, you know, resting in that mellowness, you don't pay any attention to self. Right? It's not there, but you're not paying attention to it. So the suggestion here is to, if you pay attention to that sense of self so you can see it waxing and waning rather than just notice it when it's dense, and see that it rises and falls, it comes and goes, it's not black or white, and it begins to loosen up the sense that there is a permanent abiding self. It's not that there is no self, there obviously is, but that it is an ephemeral phenomenon. So one thing you can do is just see when it's dense, when it's tight, when it's life, when it's fluid, when it seems to fade away. Another thing that we can do with this is, I think we did this the other night, where, you look inside, You can do it right now. Let's do it again anyway. So just look inside and see if you can locate where your sense of self seems to reside. So it's probably not in your feet. Your feet are down there, right? It's not in your hands. Your hands are out there. It's probably not in the top of your head. That's up there. But see where it seems to center in the body. Okay. For most people, it's somewhere in the head, maybe behind the eyes, maybe a little bit lower, somewhere in there. Some people it goes down a little bit further. And if you can find that, just notice what that sensation is. What you'll probably notice is there's a little bit of tension in it. It may be faint. There's just a little bit of tightness. And see if you can just let that tension in there soften a little bit. Just let it relax. So what happens when you do that?
It relaxes my whole body.
Your whole body relaxes, yeah.
Spreads.
Yeah, it spreads out. Mm-hmm. And as it spreads, it kind of thins out. Yeah. What else? Yeah. And you notice your sense of self gets a little fainter. Yeah. So I think I mentioned this the other night. When you have hindrances, you can 6R the hindrances, or you can 6R the sense of self that is experiencing the hindrances. Because if there is no sense of self there, then there's actually no hindrance. There's just a phenomena. So it's not a metaphysical statement. It's something you can just experience and kind of ordinary awareness.
Say that again.
This softening of self is something that you can experience in ordinary awareness. Just by locating where that is, you know, where the tension is, and just allow that to soften. Any other thoughts or comments on this? I have another fun little exercise, but something before we get to that.
You see the fMRIs that show that locator sense of self is in the posterior cingulate cortex, a little bit off to the left. And so I've been visualizing that, relaxing for a few months now, and I think it does something.
Yeah, yeah. And my suspicion is, I don't want to argue with your technology, but the people will experience that in slightly different places.
Uh-huh.
There may be brain firing, whatever, but what's actually important is where you actually experience it inside.
Yes.
Like it feels a little bit of tightness in there. And since there are not nerve receptors inside the brain, you know, it's all metaphorical anyway.
Rick Hansen says he's a neurotherapist, a neuropsychologist, mm-hmm. that it moves from here as we meditate, kind of, and comes out to the sides more. That the fMRIs show that with meditation, it is less centralized mm-hmm. and more.
It divides.
Yeah, it divides on each side, kind of evenly on both lobes, and moves out from the center toward the sides.
Yeah.
Is that in Wise Brain Bulletin, or where did you see that?
He told me that.
Yeah. So that's what Erica was describing, that sense that kind of expands out. So the hooking in with the subjective sense of it is what the most...
I feel my sense of self-esteem.
Some people do. That's the other place, sometimes down more in the heart area. You know, the Egyptian cultures, some of the Asian cultures, it tends to be down there. And I think the reason that for Westerners there's more up here is because we carry a lot of tension in our head. And so the sense of self just sort of gravitates towards where there's tension. This is another little exercise that can be fun to do. So close your eyes. And I invite you to just silently inside count from 1 to 20. And when you get to 20, open your eyes so I'll know who's finished. Okay, this was actually a contest to see who would take the longest. No. So what I invite you to do now is to do the same thing again and to just, as you're counting, notice where the numbers come from. Okay? Notice from where they arise. And open your eyes when you're done. So what do you notice? What happened? Pardon? Come from your throat?
It seems to come from my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Came from the dark space.
Yeah.
My mouth.
Pardon?
Somewhere in my mouth.
Okay.
Behind the eyes.
Behind the eyes.
It was back on the back.
Yeah.
Back of the head.
Mm-hmm. From the back of the head.
In the throat and neck was the pulse of how fast the numbers mm-hmm. came, mm-hmm. and that was the heartbeat.
Okay. So I want you to do it one more time. And this time I want you to pay attention to who or what is doing the counting. To pay attention to who or what is doing the counting. So what do you notice?
Since you asked us to do it, the numbers appear one after the other, but I didn't feel like there was any one counting. That was mine.
It was all auditory, but it seemed ridiculous. There's this voice, and it's like...
Yeah, so where did the voice come from?
Yeah, I'm speaking English, which is, what is that? It's
habitual tendency.
This memory.
Every time you have a number, there is a tension, and then there is a number releases, and then there is a tension, and then number releases.
Right, right. Yeah. So, I think these are the types of things that Bahia, you know, had been doing, looking in the senses, looking for the uncognized cognizer. And what I always come to is like Colleen. They just, you know, they seem to arise, right? Just out of not anywhere. And you can think about it, and when you start thinking about it, so, okay, well, I'm the one that's counting. But in the actual experience, if you're watching inside, the numbers just arise, right?
Doesn't that arise after the thought?
They arise after the thought?
No. Yeah. If no thought, then you won't have any number to arise. You have to think about that first.
Ah, so you think about it and then the numbers arise, that's your experience? Okay.
Well, for me, first they were just like bubbles.
Yeah.
But then when you asked me to look and see who was doing it, then it was like I had to like pull them out of there or something. You know, they weren't coming freely when I focused my attention on
right.
where they were coming from.
Right, right. So I'll invite you to do it one more time, and this time just really relax and see if you have this sense, if you can have a sense of actually nobody doing it. That you're just there and the numbers just arise, counting from 1 to 20.
They came out of order.
Free at last.
11 came before 10.
new map.
Yes.
Don't take a sobriety test.
I have a little bit of a different experience because I'm a very ordered and organized person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Bouncing around.
Right. Right. Right.
Casual, easy.
I couldn't really locate where they were coming from, although they had in the previous one they seemed.
That's really important.
Yeah, and the previous one, it seemed to be the right primordial level, which was actually somehow involved. Although we've got no sensations in our brains. So
right.
But what I noticed was that I was not just counting them, I was checking each one that I had counted the correct number.
So there was a little eye that came into that There was something that was counting. There may have been an eye. There was something that was counting.
There was
someone else was checking.
That was acting as quality control.
Yeah. So We'll take notes and have a psychological discussion about your history later. What else happened for you?
Well,
feel the tension in me moving them forward on the conveyor belt.
Uh huh.
They would show up and I would put them on a belt or
right.
something
right.
to move them forward.
Yeah.
I kind of experienced that.
Moving things along. So it's interesting, just, I mean, a simple little exercise there. All these sort of different nuances come up. I didn't come up with this in meditation. I actually came up with it at the gym. You know, some parts of my body are stronger than others. When I started doing crunches, you know, I have these little machines, and you do these, and I could do 20 or 25, and I realized I was straining. And so I just relaxed and just kind of let the body... do them, and then I was doing, 1,000 or more, if I wasn't pushing it, and the little compulsive part of me wanted to count, you know, just to see how many I had done, but you get a long sequence like that, and after a while, you know, the mind drifts off, you know, goes off, and you come back, and it's still counting, and it goes over there, and it's still counting, and just seeing that this whole counting thing, it was like. You know, at most, it was a conditioned sequence. You know, the two conditioned three and three conditioned four, and they were falling out. But I wasn't doing it because I could come and go without losing a count.
Not everybody can do that, though.
Yeah.
I couldn't count because I went looking for who was counting.
Good, because that's...
And I couldn't find that, you know, if it's on a wild goose chase.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other experience that some people have is that when you actually start looking for them, it's like the whole process falls apart. Yeah. I had a bike accident about 10 years ago, and I lost 14 hours of memory, and it was probably 5 or 6 months before I could multi-process. You know, I could have one thought, but I was like, I actually couldn't keep two of them going at once. And I remember it was about 2 or 3 months into this, at the church that I was serving, and they served lunch after church on Sunday. And I was sitting there talking to this person across the table from me, and we were having this ordinary conversation, and I realized I wasn't there. You know, that this person would ask me, something, Bill Clinton. And then there were like 3 or 4 paragraphs that were like pre-programmed in my mind that I could just speak and there was a rollout, but there was actually nobody there that was doing it. It's left me ever since with this sense, if you really stand back, if you can really sit back a little bit when you're thinking something, and not try to stop them, not try to control them, just set back a little bit and just watch the phenomena of itself. And I think all of us, you know, give anybody a topic. Ted Cruz. So you probably have 4 paragraphs, right? Just boom, they can just come out like that. Who is doing that? You know, what is... I don't have any clear answers for it, but if you just watch this, because most of us do deeply identify with our thought process.
It's memory.
Yeah. Well, so we can put a scientific understanding on it, but the important thing is actually look at the subjective, what's going on in there, where it's coming from. Mm-hmm.
I said, "Oh, well, just go ahead and do whatever you want for 15 minutes." I hadn't anything else for people,
yeah.
So I started drinking lots of strong coffee. And that. But it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did a different exercise. I did the exercise that you recommended and found that it was took very little effort, and it was reciting sort of a program.
Right.
That there was nobody doing it. It was just
right
coming out, code, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But then I decided to do another test. So I counted backward by threes from 20. And all of a sudden there was this a lot of tension. And then there was the question, what is 20 minus 3?
Right.
The answer popped up. 15. No, wrong. 17. Right. So there was this little voice. Then it was, okay, what's 17 minus 3? And so there's this question and answer. That's how I see the mind working. Or there is this, what is this? It is that. What is this? It is that. And that's what I call the antennas, our sense bases. What is this? It is that. And if it doesn't know what it is, it goes into, like, emotional land. Oh, no.
Yes.
Don't know what it is. And then the emotions kick over.
Yeah, so it's into your habitual tendencies.
Yeah.
Emotional.
But in Buddhism, so the Buddha talked about mano and citta,
mm-hmm,
as activities of the mind. So mano, the way I understand it, is the cerebral cortex. It is the analytical activity. When it kicks into reactive bhava, that is reactive tendency, that's citta.
Yeah, and so what we're looking here is actually the sense of self, and part of the key thing there was when you gave yourself a difficult activity, there was tension, and then a sense of self just, you know, arises into that.
There was a little fear in there that I was going to get this right or wrong.
Yeah,
right?
Which creates more tension, and they end up with two selves.
Yeah, so I ended up feeling the citta and watching the mano, you know, like spit out the right answers, and at the end, citta disappeared because there was relief. It was over.
Mm-hmm.
Passed the test.
Right.
I could do it.
And you know, it's a difficulty finding language for it. You have to say, I experienced.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's just...
Or you could say that in the third person.
Yeah. Well, I had a similar thing that I noticed when I was, you know, because I do the refuges and the precepts and the aspirations every morning. And so they became deeply memorized. But, you know, when they weren't deeply memorized, you know, I would be saying one precept and there was another place that was actually trying to remember what the next one was, so I wouldn't lose the... So you can have these multiple things that are going on at once. And what's interesting for me now, because it touches the fear a little bit, there is a little bit of fear. What if I miss these or lose? I don't want to skip a beat or something. But if I really just relax... and don't worry about what's coming next. Usually the whole thing will come out. But when there's a little bit of worry that starts tying itself up in knots and the sense of self gets thicker and thicker and thicker and multi-layered and just in sitting in the dark room all by myself, no one knows but me.
Because what happens is when you get anxious, you shut down the frontal lobe, and it's the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, that does the executive function of managing and organizing the activities.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, other comments or thoughts?
On everything you said?
on anything and everything.
Yeah. So,
the meaning of life is?
So, the story, you said the moral of the story early on, you said get to it. But there's another.
Absolutely, it's not my moral. Whoever stuck that in there was trying to tack one on there, but I think the story is...
The moral of the story, too, is... I spent a long time looking for something. Who knows what opportunity got to see, whatever things he forewent to get what I was after. It was really from suffering that I was in. He needed to do it. I think there was something that drove him to do that. But the other moral of the story is that, you know, that he waited a few more moments.
Would it? Would it?
Well, I know if it does. If it does, then it does. But doesn't.
I think the moral of the story is that I love opportunity cost. I know exactly what that is, and I approach all of any spiritual practice from that vantage point, especially Buddhism. I think the bigger picture is one thing that I've personally experienced is I've spent 20-some years reading about Buddhism. I mean, I can tell you all kinds of stuff about all kinds of traditions. I mean, how much time I've actually spent doing Buddhism? Like this much. And there is a vast difference between an intellectual understanding and an actual doing. And the doing is just, it's awesome. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, like the guy, the Baha'i, he had to find a teacher, right?
Right.
To finally get
that too.
To it. But that's a rare event, it sounds like, for the right the student to meet the teacher. But I guess my point is, I try to make it the other night as well, you know, death seems to me, and also like down the road, even if you throw in some reincarnations, you're ultimately going to
And so, given that we're all going to die, which we know intellectually, but maybe not other ways, what does that mean for how you treat this moment?
Ardently.
Ardently? So this is a psychological screening. What?
Like your hair is on fire.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've got 3 more minutes to live.
Giggle.
You giggle.
Yeah.
Do you set your hair on fire?
Already have.
Okay. You got 2 more minutes.
I guess you eat that strawberry as you're hanging from the rope on the cliff.
There you are. Yeah. I think in the end the thing that has the most impact above everything else is kindness. You know, that's the one that cuts through all of it for me. I had vision. I think it may be in Buddha's map of seeing what looked like 100,000, you know, incarnations just going back forever, and in this sense that, you know, we've been around doing this for hundreds of thousands of universes, never mind lifetimes, and that this particular lifetime I'm in right now is sort of a punctuation on a footnote. You know, it's like, and then in that span of time, you know, what makes any difference? What makes any difference? And for me, it's like kindness. You know, over the long haul, that's the thing that has the most impact.
And that, to me, brings up what we touched on the other night too, which is the relative value of different traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Image that you gave was, yeah, all paths go to the mountain, but not all of them reach the top. Well, is it necessary to reach the top? Kindness is, seems like it's pretty well spread around some of these traditions we've done.
Yeah, and what is the top anyway? You know, do we view it as a race up Mount Everest, or as you know, or is it a metaphor for something else, of which it gets too literalized, that, you know, turns into a competition? You know, to me, it's
lack of oxygen.
Lack of oxygen. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, the Buddha called it a path of purification. And that doesn't sound like a competition to me.
No, I don't think so. And there's lots, you know, and purification is one view of it, which is a very powerful and full one. And there are other ones too.
Well, it's interesting to me if we take that ideal of purification and we see what's polluting the waters, what's toxic, and start to look at, look at the distortions, as you call them, or you call them, the obstacles or the impurities. And it's kind of easy to see that it's a sort of a way of not an additive process, but a subtractive process. You know, I use the sort of metaphor. It's like, who wants to walk around carrying a dog turd in your pocket when you can reach back and drop it? It's just, but you have to know it's there and you have to be able to drop it.
Yeah.
Without
maybe all you have to do is change your tradition at the proper moment. Like my wife's tradition, if you are out of the truth and you croak in a misbehaving state, you do what she calls a dirt nap. And you never come back, you're just dead. Which actually is nirvana to a Buddhist. So if you can start out as a Jehovah's Witness, and then right at the right moment, go to Buddhism, you're in Nirvana. If you don't come back.
So let me
just a viewpoint over different traditions.
Just a step back out of all of our thinking, okay? If it's a path of purification, so what? What is it, if we turn to Buddha or whatever tradition, what is it that we are actually deeply, looking for or opening to? Why would we want to be purified?
The meaning of life is to improve yourself over the course of your lifetime.
Right? Wow, right. I didn't know that.
Isn't that what it's all about? I mean, is that what we're talking about here?
I think.
Yeah. That was to survive until you get to death. The purpose of life is to survive until you die.
I think.
Yeah, that too.
I think that life doesn't have a purpose. That's just...
Aww.
It just is. To assign purpose to something, you have to have a frame of reference outside it.
So you have to have a self.
Purpose is always in relationship to something.
Because, yeah. For instance, maybe from a Buddhist point of view, the purpose of life is to seek and know the truth, live wisely, and treat other people as a result kindly. Across your lifespan as you improve your level of understanding and knowledge and practice.
So I sit here and think, so why am I involved in this right now? Why am I sitting here, coming down here with you guys? Is this just part of a neurotic pattern playing out? Well, I'm sure there's a little bit of that. What is it that I'm deeply drawn towards? What's this opening out? And and I think it's something we can feel, and it's something we can sense. And as soon as we try to articulate it, it shrinks. To say that there is a purpose to life means there is something outside it that assigns, that assigns it its purpose. If we're out, what's the purpose of the universe? Right? There, it's got no purpose. It just is. It just is. You can take some part of it and measure it against some other part and say, well, this is its purpose over here, but basically it just is. And ultimately, for me, there's something about, life is. And here we are in this moment. And what are we going to do with it? And I can't quite find words to it, but there's something that hovers around kindness that sort of points, in the direction of something that resonates, deeply. So along the way towards kindness, maybe there's some purifications of some of the stuff that throw it out of balance. Makes a lot of sense to me. And I think Buddhism is a purification, this whole process is. But why would I want to do that?
Because it's the only game in town, ultimately. There isn't really.
We might as well do something. If we were here, and unless we want to not be here, we might as well do something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me, having discovered this and accepting about life being suffering, seems to make sense to try to reduce that suffering for myself and the self and others.
We're gone far enough for tonight? No, I just want to. Nisargadatta. You know Nisargadatta? He's a guru. I mean, seemed to be fully enlightened. He was the son of a gun, too, in a lot of ways. I had this tobacco shop in Mumbai. And he said once, love says I'm everything. Love says I'm everything. Wisdom says I'm nothing. Between those two, my life flows.
And he was selling tobacco?
Got to make a living. So tomorrow we'll pick up here and look at self from a different perspective. I think that evolutionary forces have wired into us this a sense of self. I think it's an evolutionary, I won't say evolutionary accident, but it was not some grand design. It was just to have to do with survival. And in Western culture, we take this independent self and basically raise it to almost a cult status. So when you try to talk about non-self, it's like we're really paddling into a gale, of all these forces. And I think that there is a way of slipping around the sense of self adroitly. And I think it's a way that wasn't really available during the Buddha's time. And so tomorrow, that's what we'll explore.
Okay. Say that again.
Tomorrow, that's what we'll explore. Oh, there's a way of slipping around the sense of self that wasn't available in the Buddha's time. It's another approach to it that. So we'll take a little bit of time tomorrow to unpack all that. But that's what we'll. That's
is
what
it
we'll,
Freudian?
No, it's not Freudian. It's not Freudian at all.
We can't take drugs and alcohol.
Okay. So the rabbi came down to the altar and started wailing and beating his chest, saying, I'm nobody, I'm nobody, I'm nobody. And the cantor came down and knelt down at the altar next to him and started wailing and beating his chest and saying, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody, I'm nobody." And the janitor came down and kneeled down next to the rabbi and the cantor and started wailing and beating his chest and saying, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody, I'm nobody." And the cantor turned to the rabbi and said, "Look who thinks he's nobody." May we just be and know that that's enough. May all beings know that they're enough. May it be so. Namaste.